Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. We're going to have a Solartopia. This is the Solartopia of Green Power and Wellness Show. Back at you for another hour of scintillating talk and serious meditation. And we got a great guest back with us, actually, a repeater, because he's so good and so smart. And going to be joined. We got Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, also going to be joined by Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, how are you today?
Good, Harvey. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Good, although it's been a hell of a week. So let's talk about things. We're going to focus on nuclear power. You are one of the great experts and one of the great activists in the country. We had a full hour with you 2 weeks ago, which I posted at the archive, and we're going to have another hour because we never actually got to a bunch of stuff that we need to talk about having to do with nuclear power. Primarily, we're going to start with health and safety. Last week we talked, and we're also going to talk about economics, and we're going to talk about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is a misnomer if there ever was one. We generally refer to it now as no real chance, or nobody really cares. But I do want to talk a little bit before we jump in here about the bring down of the plane in Ukraine. It's terrifying, actually. I mean, all bets are off, and we now see that missiles are striking near the Tel Aviv airport, and they've shut the Tel Aviv airport. I mean, you know, in a world like this, where can we possibly have room for atomic energy from nuclear power plants? It's absolutely insane. I do remember years ago, we haven't heard this discussion for a while, Kevin, but before you were born, there was talk of what would happen if an airplane actually hit an atomic power plant. Greenpeace made an astonishing video, actually, it's really terrifying, of a family on a beach and an airplane flies over and crashes into a nuclear plant. So these kinds of things, thinking about the unthinkable, as Herman Kahn would have said so many years ago, has started to become a reality. All I can say, I never ever discuss Israel or the Middle East except to say I wish they'd find a way to solve this thing, but thank God that they don't have any commercial reactors in the immediate area there.
Well, it is a unreported story from both conflict zones. Unfortunately, the risk of some of these munitions hitting nuclear power plants. So you've got Zaporizhzhia in eastern Ukraine, which is Europe's biggest atomic reactor. There's several reactors on one site. They're not the Chernobyl RBMK design. They're the VVER, pressurized water reactor, but they're still very vulnerable, of course. And in Israel, there is the Dimona nuclear weapons facility, which actually Hamas rockets were targeted at one point. And there were some rockets that landed in Dimona, but no apparent damage to the atomic facility. But it's something that has been warned about for a long time. So you've got Bennett Ramberg's book from the early 1980s called Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, where he was warning about, you know, outright military conflict. And, of course, after 9-11, something the 9-11 Commission documented itself, amazingly, was that Mohammed Atta, the lead attacker on New York City, the first one to fly a plane into the World Trade Center, had wanted to attack Indian Point and ran it up the totem pole at Al-Qaeda and was denied permission, and so back to the original plan. But Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, before he was captured in an interview with an Al Jazeera journalist that got published in a Spanish newspaper, and then under waterboarding by the United States at Guantanamo, revealed that the original plan for 9-11 was 10 hijacked airliners, two of which would be flown into nuclear power plants. So there was some press out of Britain, I think it was The Guardian, it might have been The Times of London, that reported shortly after 9/11 that the fourth plane may have been headed towards Three Mile Island, although kind of the official version now is that it was headed towards the U.S. Capitol or the White House. So, you know, it's been warned about for many decades, and God forbid, like we talked about on the last show, God forbid that something like that ever happened.
Yeah, and you know, you hear the discussion, and then the industry comes back and tells you how strong the containment domes are, and you know that they are absolutely not required. There is no requirement for any of the commercial reactors operating in the world, all 430 some of them, to have been tested to withstand a jet crash.
You know, they're such masters of deception. You know, it's not a question, really, of crashing through the containment domes on these reactors. There are so many soft spots at atomic reactors. And as Dave Lockbaum of Union of Concerned Scientists has put it, if you take out the brain, the body is still to follow. So guess what? The control rooms at nuclear power plants are not within containment. The high-level radioactive waste storage pools are not within containment. Of course, the switchyards, the essential electricity for the safety and cooling systems, are outdoors and very vulnerable. So, unfortunately, these plants are sitting ducks to terrorist attacks.
Yes, and not only that, but the cooling pumps. You know, Arne Gundersen has pointed out, and you mentioned it when you were on 2 weeks ago, that the intake pumps for the coolant water at Fukushima were destroyed essentially by the tsunami, and they could you know, it would take virtually nothing to destroy the intake pipes for any nuclear power plant. God forbid. I mean, I hate to be talking about this stuff on the air, but these plants are ridiculously vulnerable.
Well, what's really ironic is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hides a lot of information behind so-called supposed security sensitive status. It's not even a classified status under law. And just one example of the abuse by the NRC is the situation down in South Carolina at Oconee, which is a three-reactor complex downstream of a very large dam called the Jocassee Dam. It's a reservoir. And an NRC staff person named Perkins did an analysis of what would happen if that dam were to break and a wall of water came down that valley. And his analysis showed that those three reactors would melt down very much like Fukushima Daiichi melted down under the tsunami wall of water. And Perkins...
Yeah, and, you know, we're told here, you know, the industry and its apologists are saying, well, Fukushima happened because of a tsunami, which is not true. It really happened because of the earthquake. It couldn't, you know, no plants in the United States, except for Diablo Canyon, of course, are vulnerable to a tsunami. Therefore, we couldn't have a Fukushima. Now, I have read, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, that up to 36 reactors in the United States are potentially vulnerable to dam breaks that could create tsunami-like conditions.
Yes, and Perkins was the one who outed that, only the NRC would not publish his findings. And so he had to go to the Office of Inspector General at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He's working within the system trying to get this word out. He was the first to admit that, you know, a dam break is low probability but very high consequence. So incredibly, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hid his revelations behind this cloak of secrecy, blaming it on, you know, the 9/11 attacks, and we can't get this out there, when in fact it's very much a safety issue. And, you know, other federal agencies have reported on how bad a shape our dams are in this country. So North Anna in Virginia, 11 miles from the epicenter of the August 2011 earthquake that was larger than North Anna was designed to withstand, and damage was done to that facility, there's a dam on Lake Anna. And if you lose the ultimate heat sink, as Arne has warned, Arne Gundersen, you lose the ability to cool the reactor. And so that specific dam on Lake Anna is regarded as having a grade D, as in the ABCDF. So it's just above failing in terms of its status. And it's not the only one. Out in Nebraska, We call it Port Calhoun now because of the flooding at Fort Calhoun Nuclear Power Plant in summer of 2011, historic floods on the Missouri River. The plant was literally with water lapping at all of its buildings, and the dams were the real question. Again, Arne Gundersen warned there were any number of dams upstream that if any one of them had failed, likely would have taken out the other dams beneath it, and this monster wave of water would have come down the Missouri and hit that plant. And in fact, one of the dams upstream was being eroded. The flow of water over the top that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was actually in charge of, they were trying to do this high wire act, let enough water go over the top of the dam that it didn't wreck the dam. But the water flowing over the top was slowly eroding, or not so slowly, eroding the base of the dam away. So by the skin of our teeth, we averted a catastrophe in summer 2011 in Nebraska.
Yeah, well, the question is, how many skins of our teeth do we have to give away here? My favorite story at Port Calhoun, they built a dam. They took a giant rubber sausage, essentially, and filled it with water, ironically, to hold back the water from the river.
Yep.
And then some idiot backed a backhoe or some kind of heavy equipment into the dam, into the water-filled sausage, and all the water from the sausage went pouring out. I mean, and this is our nuclear industry?
And that let the floodwaters then lap at the base of the containment building. And an amazing thing is that, and Dave Lochbaum, when the NRC does something right, he will give them credit. And in this particular case, there were NRC staff people a year and a half before who were making some noise about how unprepared for a flood Fort Calhoun was. And so some upgrades were put in place just in the nick of time. They didn't really know what was coming. And so, you know, a radioactive bullet dodged. What the danger was those floodwaters could have simply poured down doorways and down stairwells into safety-sensitive areas of the plant. And even though that was dodged, there was still a serious problem that happened at Fort Calhoun in summer of 2011. There was a fire that was burning, smoldering for days, and workers smelled the smoke but did nothing about it, didn't even look to see what the problem was. And the NRC gave Fort Calhoun a red finding, which is the top-notch safety violation that they can give under their regulations, which was on the books for like a year. So Fort Calhoun was in some hot water for letting a fire burn within its plant for days without even knowing what the problem was.
Yeah, unfortunately, a red card doesn't take you off the field like it does in soccer. We're talking with Kevin Camps of the Beyond Nuclear organization, one of our great experts and activists on the commercial atomic power reality here. And we've been talking about floods. You know, it's amazing. Whenever I get Kevin on or Paul Gunter, people who are knowledgeable about the industry, and I think I know what we're going to talk about, there's so much involved with the commercial atomic reactor industry in this world that we never know what's actually going to come up when push comes to shove. So one thing that's happening now, I'd like you to talk about, Kevin, and I put something up at nukefree.org about this. One of the commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has taken a job overseas promoting nuclear power, but is refusing to step down from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to regulate the industry he's now directly working for. Can you give us the detail on this? I mean, you know, it's another Alice in Wonderland meets Franz Kafka kind of situation.
Yeah, Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, was just quoted as saying that Magwood is a disaster, and I would just correct him and say Magwood has been a disaster from the very beginning. Back in 2009, when we heard rumors that President Obama was going to nominate him, we just couldn't believe it, because Magwood's background is 7 years as Director of Office of Nuclear Energy at the U.S. Department of Energy, which is explicitly promotional of nuclear power. And then before that and after that, he was in industry working for companies like Westinghouse Nuclear. He even served as a consultant to various Japanese nuclear industry, such as Tokyo Electric Power Company. We just couldn't believe that Obama was going to nominate him. And so 100 groups came together, wrote a letter to President Obama, and pretty much said, just don't do this. The NRC is a safety regulator, not a promoter. Do not blur this line like it used to be decades ago in the Atomic Energy Commission days. He did anyway. He nominated Magwood. The Senate, incredibly, despite our protests, confirmed Magwood. And it has been a disaster for the past 5 years. And the final straw for Harry Reid, who unfortunately let Magwood's nomination get confirmed in the Senate, he could have stopped that, was when Magwood went back on a promise he had made to Reid and continued to promote the Yucca Mountain Dump, which is Reid's, no-go zone. And he really lashed out at Magwood after that and called him a liar and a rat, that Magwood would never serve as a chair of any agency under Reid's, Senate majority leadership. And it was an interesting choice of words because Reid had let him get on the commission. And really what had happened was Magwood led the mutiny against NRC Chairman Yazko, who was a former Reid staffer on the Yucca issue. And so Reid really took all this very personally. But we saw that coming years earlier and tried to warn all the decision makers. And now, under the leadership of Attorney Diane Curran in Washington, D.C., another coalition, this time of three dozen groups, has called for Magwood's resignation and even his recusal back to the beginning of his courting this job at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It's called the Nuclear Energy Agency, based in Paris, which is explicitly promotional, although Magwood's now trying to deny that. He's refused to resign. He's refused to, post-date, recuse himself on votes going back to earlier this year. And just the other day, just yesterday, Diane Curran, on behalf of the coalition, wrote to President Obama and asked him to call for Magwood's resignation.
Well, it's pretty amazing, and I think people have to understand, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was set up because originally in the United States, atomic energy was regulated and promoted by the Atomic Energy Commission. And so there was finally an exasperation among the general public and a demand that the regulatory function be separated from the promotional function. And that's been since the mid-1970s. It hasn't worked all that well, but at least it was a little bit. I mean, we have had a small handful of people on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who've actually tried to regulate, one of them being Greg Yazko, who was the previous chair. And a guy like Magwood now comes along, and he's on this Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which was set up allegedly to be a good cop, a separate agency from the promotional side, and he's now blurring the lines that were established more than 30 years ago. Actually, it's almost 40 years. It's quite shocking.
The Huffington Post scooped the story on Magwood's behavior at Department of Energy, where he actually did a mutiny against his boss at Office of Nuclear Energy and took his job, became the director. He was deputy director, working in cahoots with Alex Flint, who was a Capitol Hill staffer for Senator Strangelove, Pete Domenici of New Mexico. And guess where Alex Flint went after that episode? He went off to Nuclear Energy Institute to become the top lobbyist, vice president for government relations, while Magwood took over Office of Nuclear Energy at DOE and then went on to be an NRC commissioner. And Magwood was scheming to do the same thing at NRC, oust Yazko and take his job, become chairman. And Reid was having none of that.
Well, yes. And so the new chairwoman, Allison McFarland, is, I don't know. Kevin, what do you think of how chairwoman McFarland has performed so far?
Well, I think her overriding goal is to maintain collegiality at the commission, because the whole Yazko witch hunt shook the agency to its foundations, really. The other four commissioners, led by Magwood, went after Yazko, wanted his head, eventually forced his resignation under the pressure, cooking up things like accusations of yelling at women staffers at NRC. It was all secondhand, but Magwood laid that out there in a congressional hearing. So Yazko eventually had enough and resigned, and was replaced by McFarland, who...
Well, wait, let's back up a little bit, because none of our listeners may not know. Greg Yazko was the first chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to actually regulate. I mean, he really made public a lot of the serious problems with the commercial reactor industry. He was hardly anti-nuclear, not at all, but
right.
he certainly pushed the industry to do some things that any sane human being would expect him to do. And
I think,
you know,
Carl Grossman really hit it on the nose when he said that Greg Yasko was insufficiently pro-nuclear for the industry, and so they had to get rid of him. But you're right. I mean, he played a big role in the whole demise of Yucca Mountain, to give him credit. He invoked emergency powers during the Fukushima crisis in order to get the other pro-nuclear commissioners out of his way so that he could get things done in real time. And for those kinds of actions, his days were numbered.
Yeah, but and, you know, we were treated then or subjected to this insane Kabuki Act where the four commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission were attacking the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for being mean. I mean, come on. You know, I was very sorry that Greg Yasko resigned. You know, I don't understand why he had to. He had the backing of Barbara Boxer, the senator from California. I mean, maybe you can tell us, Kevin, why did he resign?
Well, I think they had hauled him through the mud for long enough. His term was coming to an end. It was pretty clear that the commission itself was completely paralyzed by this hatred, this seething struggle against the other four commissioners. And so I think he saw he had a few months left and decided that it was time to go. McFarlane was tapped. She wrote the book on why Yucca Mountain is a bad idea, and that was good enough for Harry Reid, so he was going to support her, and that was good enough for Obama, who needs the support of his Senate Majority Leader to get things done. And so McFarlane, who had served on the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, is a PhD geologist, was tapped, and she's largely maintained a role of, I call it, Cub Scout den mother. This commission is going to get along. We're not going to punch each other in the nose. We're not going to yell at each other. But
and we're not going to regulate. So how would you – the key question for our listeners, I think, Kevin, is, Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, how would you rate the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as an organization that that's charged with – regulating these reactors? How safe can America feel with the current Nuclear Regulatory Commission in terms of the safety of the reactors, the 100 reactors now operating in the United States?
The NRC is completely captured by the industry it's supposed to regulate, and Chairwoman McFarlane, in her 2 years in office now, has only really stood up a couple times in a big way and stuck her neck out. One of them was on post-Fukushima radiological filters on Fukushima twin designs in the United States. She lost 4-1, but she wrote a stinging dissent. She pointed out...
Oh, wait, now let's stop on this here. What happened here was that after Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was forced to confront the reality that there are 23 reactors in the United States that are identical to 5 at Fukushima, right?
And that was Yasko's project, his Fukushima Lessons Learned project. That's right.
And so the chairwoman, Allison McFarlane, did what, and what happened to her?
She voted in favor of filters. If you're going to put new and improved hardened vents on the Mark I designs to save their too small, too weak containment from absolute rupture and release of radioactivity with these new hardened vents, which supposedly are happening very slowly in the United States, at least put filters on these vents so that there won't be a delay as workers hope their families get far enough away before they hit the button to vent the core, and so to vent the radiological containment structure to save it. And incredibly, by a 4-1 vote, the other commissioner said, nope, we're not going to put filters on. And McFarlane pointed out that the only countries in the world not requiring filters on their GE, BWR, Mark I's and Mark II's are the United States, India, and Mexico, not known for their nuclear safety regimes. Everybody else in the world is putting filters on or already has put filters on, but we're not going to do it.
How much would it have cost the industry to put these filters on these commercial reactors?
Just some tens of millions of dollars, which represents just some tens of days of profits at their atomic reactors.
So we're not talking about billions of dollars here. We're not talking about, you know, half the defense budget. We're talking about basically petty cash for the nuclear industry, and they don't want to do it. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to keep us safe from these atomic reactors, voted 4-1 to let the industry get away with this.
And McFarland just did the same thing, lost 4-1 on this issue of expedited transfer out of vulnerable storage pools for high-level radioactive waste. Again, a post-Fukushima issue, because we came pretty darn close to a catastrophic fire in a fuel storage pool at Fukushima Daiichi. So she voted and has had this position for a long time to get the waste out of the pools or at least study the issue further, where her NRC staff of nearly 4,000 staff people and the other four commissioners have all said, we're done with this issue, we don't want to think about it anymore, don't even bring it up anymore, we're not doing it, we're not thinking about it.
All right, so explain to us exactly, Kevin, we're going to take a break in about four minutes. Tell us what the issue is here, because this is really critical. With the atomic reactor of spent fuel rods, waste fuel rods, sitting in swimming pools around the country and around the world. But tell us what happened at the NRC and why this was an issue.
Well, you've got a lot more radioactivity in these storage pools for high-level radioactive waste than you even have in an operating reactor core. But incredibly enough, there's a lot of shortcuts being taken. The pools are not located in a radiological containment structure like the reactors are. And there's no makeup water if you lose the cooling water. There's no backup power to run the cooling systems on the pools. All these shortcuts to save money, because what could possibly go wrong? Well, we saw at Fukushima Daiichi that the pools were out of control for days, if not weeks. And they were doing desperate things like trying to drop cooling water by helicopter into the pools to prevent a catastrophic fire that would have dwarfed the releases from the reactors that took place. And those were monstrous enough.
Well, this means that the spent fuel rods in the spent fuel pools would have lost, they're covered with water, as they have to be. And if the water had drained out of those pools, then we would have had a worse disaster than when the reactor cores themselves melted. Is that what you're saying?
A worse disaster just at Fukushima Daiichi Unit Number 4, a worse disaster by an order of magnitude. That's how much radioactivity is in the pool.
And it's still, well, I guess now we can talk about this a little bit. So, but the bottom line is here on this decision, people want those fuel rods removed from the fuel pools and put in dry casks. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That would be an improvement for sure, but it would not mean the waste is safe. And that's why we've also called for hardening of the dry casks on site, which means actually designing them well, building them well, and designing them and building them with things in mind like terrorist attacks, which is currently not the case.
Well, and so essentially, let's put some perspective on this before we break here. We have thousands and thousands of spent fuel rods sitting in spent fuel pools covered with water. And in the United States, because we don't have a repository, actually there's no repository in the world for high-level spent fuel rods, they are sitting there, and they could lose coolant and have a worse disaster than we could have at an actual core melt, of which we've now had three at Fukushima, and, of course, one at Chernobyl and partial one at Three Mile Island. So we are now begging the nuclear industry to remove these fuel rods from the pools, which in all cases in the United States and many cases around the world far exceeds what they were designed to hold. Is that correct?
Oh, it's much worse here in the United States than even in Japan. So like Pilgrim near Boston and Fermi 2 south of Detroit are Fukushima twin designs. They're Mark 1s. And every single fuel rod that's ever been irradiated in those reactors is being stored in their high-level radioactive waste storage pools. They haven't moved a single assembly.
And so we are begging the industry now, with no help from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to force the industry to remove the fuel rods, at least to bring the fuel pools down to design specification. And we want the fuel rods put in boxes, basically dry casks, all they are is boxes, and have them hardened so against terrorist attacks. none of which the nuclear industry is willing to do. Is that right?
Yeah, they are deferring dry cask storage for as long as possible into the future just to save money. They're saving some tens of millions on the dry cask pads, and then each cask is going to cost a couple million bucks. So that's the kind of money they're saving while putting whole regions of the country at risk.
We have been talking with Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. Paul Gunter, also from Beyond Nuclear, is on hold. We'll come back to both of them. I'm sure that this has been very unsettling to everybody. I've been doing this more than 40 years, and I still can't deal with this crap. It's unbelievable. We'll take a short break. We're here from our my good buddy Dana Lyons, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you for staying with us, Paul and Kevin.
Thank you.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
Bears. We need lots of forests for the bears. We need lots of forests for the nuclear power plants, too. We are back at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Another half hour to go. We had a scintillating, disturbing, depressing, informative half hour with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear. And he is now joined by Paul Gunter, also from Beyond Nuclear. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Harvey.
And Kevin, you still with us?
I'm still here, yeah.
All right, good, good. So as we were finishing up, we had to face the horrible realities of what's happening with nuclear waste around the United States and around the world. And we dealt also with the perils of Mr. Magwood, the current commissioner from the NRC who refuses to resign. Is he going to resign? Is he going to go to work full time for this outfit in Europe, or what's he going to do?
Yeah, he's moving to Paris. It's going to be his full-time job. He'll be Director General of the Nuclear Energy Agency.
But is he going to continue on the commission while he does that?
No, he said he would resign from the commission in September when he moves to Paris.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought he just kind of wanted to commute between the two.
That would be interesting. His term's coming up to an end, as Apostolakis just did at the end of June, and there was no indication that Obama was going to renominate him, so he kind of saw the writing on the wall and got a better job, I guess.
Well,
and he's been sort of a wrecker ball inside the NRC as well. I mean, working for industry, we would certainly expect him to, go on a burn and raise of safety standards as he leaves the agency.
What do you mean?
I just think that he's been a hitman all along for the industry, and it is a concern that he will do damage to, what regulatory oversight is left of the agency over the nuclear industry, to make it easier for the industry to cover its financial gain and, put this very tenuous nuclear economy ahead of public health and safety. That's been his job all along, and obviously he's staying on to further that end.
Well, and he's going to stay until September. So are there any major decisions coming up in front of the commission that, that this guy is going to affect?
Yeah, the Fermi 3 new reactor proposal, for one, we are at the very end of that licensing proceeding, and we got ruled against on our quality assurance contention, which Arne Gundersen was our expert witness. We appealed the licensing board ruling to the full commission, and the full commission now is racing to hear this appeal and get it done with, get rid of it, get rid of us. And apparently they're doing that so that Magwood will have a vote, perhaps because, as I mentioned, Apostolakis is gone. So if Magwood is also gone, it would, you know, if McFarland did the right thing, we would lose 2-1. And that might not look good enough for industry. So they want it to at least be 3-1 against. So they're racing through this thing so that Magwood can vote against us.
So do we have a filibuster here? What's the strategy to drag this out?
Certainly, you know, Diane Curran's work on behalf of the Environmental Coalition is really the name of the game. Get Magwood out of office as soon as possible. This should have happened many months ago. As soon as he started applying for this job, courting this job to promote, he should have resigned right then. And an infamous example of this is Jeffrey Merrifield on the commission, who went to work immediately after leaving the commission for the Shaw Group, which specializes in new reactor construction.
As opposed to the
saying,
Shaw of Iran.
His last act as an NRC commissioner was to change a single word under regulations, the word construction. He made most of a nuclear power plant's construction now a pre-construction activity. NRC could approve it with a limited work authorization. We're talking about the turbine building. We're talking about everything at the nuclear plant except for the reactor and its containment. They could go ahead and build without even an environmental impact statement.
Oh, my God. They always turn around and say, well, we've spent all this money, so you got to give us approval. And what you're saying now is that they can pretty much build the whole damn thing and without an approval, and then turn around and come and ask for the approval for the last piece, which is the reactor core. Is that correct?
After spending, you know, perhaps hundreds of millions or billions, and they actually did do that in Georgia at Vogtle 3 and 4 and at Summer Units 2 and 3, they broke a lot of ground long before they had the go-ahead from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in terms of the license application.
Paul, did you want to add to that?
I think it's, you know, there's also Magwood's hidden agenda that is a concern. You know, it's, you know, clearly he has and will be in the industry's best, working in the industry's best interest to his last day. And so, you know, there's much to be revealed still.
All right. All right. So listen, we've dealt with the regulatory issues now. I want to get and make sure, which I didn't talk about last time, that we talk about health impacts, and especially the health impacts of Fukushima. And we have heard, we have seen, I had Joe Mangano on a while ago, we have seen significant health impacts at Fukushima on the population of children there. There is a study ongoing from the Fukushima Medical University, which is a private institution that gets government funding, of almost 400,000 children. And they are showing a 40 times normal thyroid cancer rate and a 40 times normal thyroid abnormality rate. And these rates can only go up as the children mature. Have you at Beyond Nuclear been following this story? And tell us what you know.
Yeah, well, Harvey, obviously what we're concerned about is that this, what we're looking at with these statistics is really the upside of a spike that will continue for decades to come. We're only beginning to see, you know, what we're seeing in these elevated cases are early onsets within the first year to 3 years, but thyroid cancer is, its onset can be up to four decades. So, you know, this is going to be an ongoing dilemma and health catastrophe, and the iodine exposures to thyroids, particularly in children, is only the beginning of a bow wave of disease that is yet to come.
And have you seen any numbers or any reports that would confirm what Joe Mangano is telling us?
Again, what we're seeing are early onsets. This is we're in the third year of a etiology that takes many years, and even with the current generation and the next generation, a big concern is that the genetic damage, for example, can even skip a generation. So the where we see children and even fetus and embryo being affected by radiation, both from their that's passing through the uterus of their mother, and then uptake in what children eat and drink that's radioactively contaminated. These kinds of exposures and cellular damage, damage to DNA, will be manifesting itself for generations to come. I mean, I think one of the concerns that we've got right now are groups like the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. You know, we call them UNSCEAR. But they just released a report back in April 2014, basically a propaganda piece where they say, on behalf of the nuclear industry, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and the Fukushima disaster, that they've seen no discernible increase in future cancer rates to be expected. Now, the operable words here are discernible and also are not expected. This has been met by criticism by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who laid out that UNSCEAR has underestimated radiation releases. Even underestimating what Tokyo Electric Power Company had released for iodine-131. And people should know that UNSCEAR, works hand-in-hand with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which clearly promotes nuclear power as its stated mission plan.
Yes. So now, I did have a show with Joe Mangano and someone from IPPNW, and this whole issue of the United Nations working to promote nuclear power and to hide the health impacts, I know that Beyond Nuclear has worked a lot on this, and you have Helen Caldicott on your board. Give us a rundown of how the UN is tied in with the nuclear industry on this.
The essential connection is between the International Atomic Energy Agency and the World Health Organization, where they operate as left hand and right hand to both promote nuclear power from the IAEA side and then shield the nuclear industry by covering over the impacts of and consequences of radiation exposure by the World Health Organization. And this has been an ongoing battle for since these agencies were organized, where issues like internal exposures to radiation are basically obfuscated, where worker exposures are underestimated, or investigations into incidents like Tokyo Electric Power Company workers were covering their body dosimeteries with lead as to prevent the devices from actually accurately recording. And IAEA and the World Health Organization basically cover for these kinds of operations.
So the United Nations, when we see, of Of course, the media stopped covering nuclear at all. But when they once in a blue moon, when it filters through and they have so-called experts, they bring on these guys from the United Nations. And what you're saying is what was also said by Joe Mangano and the IPPNW on my previous show, that the UN is essentially a pro-nuclear organization. I mean, is that fair?
That's quite accurate. Clearly, one of the big concerns, for example, is that the World Health Organization and the IAEA basically discount the radiation exposures to fetus and embryo and their vulnerability. And, you know, they're going by the 200 Joe Sixpack exposure rates. They discount non-cancer-related, you know, diseases like Chernobyl heart, where cesium-137 is a muscle seeker, and one of the chief and most important muscles in your body is the heart. And cesium-137, from many independent scientific research accounts, is showing that it is impacting the populations exposed to Chernobyl fallout. But you don't get any of this from the World Health Organization or from the IAEA. In fact, they continue to obfuscate these kinds of health consequences.
Kevin, did you want to add into that?
Just it goes right to the heart of the history of IAEA. You know, they were founded principally to stop the spread of nuclear weapons technology, stop proliferation. And in exchange, the fatal flaw of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the IAEA was this promise by the nuclear weapons holders that if the have-nots would not develop nuclear weapons, they would be given nuclear power technology. And so this Faustian fission goes back to the very first days of the IAEA, and they go out of their way to cover for nuclear power because they see it as their founding trade-off. But, you know, as Mohammed El-Baradei, the IAEA director, was leaving office and he'd already received the Nobel Peace Prize, he had the courage or the clarity to just say out loud that the only reason that a dozen Arab countries want nuclear power technology is so that they will have a pathway to the bomb if they choose to take that pathway. Anywhere nuclear power goes, nuclear weapons can soon follow if the holders of the technology choose to go there. And so it's a schizophrenic and self-defeating, you know, mission that IAEA has to spread nuclear power technology while trying to keep a lid on nuclear weapons. It's bound to fail.
Yeah, and let's keep things in perspective by never forgetting that in the 1970s, the United States and France tried to build or to give the Shah of Iran 36 nuclear reactors. And can you imagine the situation in the Middle East today if Iran had had 36 or had today 36 commercial reactors? I can't even begin to imagine it. We're talking with Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear Organization. Amazingly enough, we have less than 10 minutes left to discuss nuclear power. What do you guys think the health impacts will be at Fukushima, and how does that relate to what we've got going here in the United States?
Well, Harvey, the big problem is the uncertainty of, does this accident actually have an end? It's ongoing right now. There is no control of the radioactive releases that are currently coming out of the reactor, 1, 2, and 3. You know, they've been talking about building this ice wall around, you know, to sink these pipes 90 feet into the ground, spaced 3 feet apart for a mile circumference around these damaged radioactive wreckage, and then pump coolant in to form an ice wall. But what we've seen so far is that they have not been able to, in the pilot operation, it's actually more like a dirty radioactive Slurpee. The water is not freezing. They can't get the refrigerant down into what they're looking for is a minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. The best that they've been able to do with this pilot is 58 degrees. So The ice wall is failing, and the radioactivity continues to flow into the ocean and into the groundwater. These are going to be health impacts far into the future. So you can't really put an estimate on what are going to be the health consequences if we have an accident ongoing now after 3 years.
It's insane. The ice wall to begin with. I mean, it's like out of a Batman comic or something. And anybody that believed that they were actually going to pull that off must have been on some drug. Again, we're with Kevin Campson, Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. What do we have going in the United States parallel to Fukushima? I mean, what I'm seeing now is that the old reactors, like the Mark I General Electric reactors, we have 23 of them here in the United States and, you know, five at Fukushima Daiichi, are growing weaker and weaker. They're less and less competitive economically, and yet the industry is trying to prop them up. They're going into Illinois and other states now and trying to get subsidies to keep these old reactors operating.
And they're not even economical. Not only are they dangerous, but they're not making money. And so in order to keep morale up in this industry, they are continue to operate these uneconomical, unsafe, and aging reactors. These are essentially the jalopies of the nuclear age. And it's a 60s technology, these Mark I's. And I might add the Mark II's are no better. We have eight of those, including the Columbia nuclear generating station, which sits at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation along with some of the oldest nuclear bomb waste in a very seismically complex area that sits below a dam that has a 65-foot crack in it. I mean, there is so much just on a hair trigger right now that could essentially create the identical situation that they had at Fukushima Daiichi, where you have a massive, in this case at Columbia, would be a inland tsunami, and not only just the Columbia Nuclear Power Station, which is one of these Fukushima-style reactors, but also combined with the Hanford nuclear waste, triggered by an earthquake. So, you know, it's all this kind of diabolical facelift that the industry continues to put itself through with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission as the cosmetic surgeon, when really this is a dying industry and they're looking to milk the last penny out of every one of us.
Yep. Okay. Well, on that happy note, let's just conclude. We got 3 minutes left. That thankfully, renewable technology is coming on fast. None of these reactors should be operating in any way, shape, or form if their true costs and gambles were factored in. And we're thankful for people like Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps for continuing the fight. What's your website, guys?
BeyondNuclear.org.
Yep.
BeyondNuclear.org. We're going to get William Magwood out of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as fast as possible. I hope we get somebody decent to take his place. That'll be an interesting battle. I mean, what does the Tea Party think of nuclear power? But at any rate, the good news is that these nuclear reactors, if they ever were, are certainly not economical now. They're not competitive. They can't stand up to fracked gas, which is, of course, not something we support, but they can't stand up to renewable energy either. And our job at Beyond Nuclear and Nuke Free and the Solartopia show is to get these reactors shut as fast as possible and pray that we don't get another Fukushima situation, because as Kevin and Paul know all too well, it is certainly possible. This has been... Guys, thank you so much for being back with me. I appreciate
thank you,
it. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York, in Indian Point Territory at PRN for getting the show going. Thank you, Pete Seeger, for singing that song. And we'll be back again next week with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, talking about the coming age of renewable energy.
Either way, We got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.